That we just sang is a perfect song for the things that we're going to be talking about in this lesson. Where is it that you have placed your hope? And we're in a church setting right now, so we know that the answer we're supposed to say is what we just sang about. But functionally in your life, when the storms and the trials and the hardships come, where are the first people that you go? Who are the first people you go to? What are the first things that you do for some kind of security and comfort? We've been talking for these last few lessons about the deep emotional needs that everybody has. Everybody has a need for meaning. Everybody has a need for hope. But if you're not finding these things in Christ, all other things are sinking sand. John chapter 10, verse 10 says, "The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly." If you make anything other than Jesus your shepherd, your life is being stolen, killed, and destroyed. And when we compare some of the sinking sands of this world to what Jesus has to offer, and we start to deconstruct what the world says is the way that we get hope, and then contrast that with the biblical approach, I think we see that Christ is indeed the solid rock, and we need to stand firm on Him. But just as an observation about the way people are, we all need a sense of hope in life. If we're going to have an abundant life, if you have a bleak outlook about the future, that's going to affect you in the here and now. You ever known people that had all kinds of worries and concerns about global warming, and they had all these concerns about the economy and all these concerns about politics, and we're all going to die and all of this, and they were not the happiest people to be around because they were just addicted to the news and all the things that we're told to worry about all the time. What would be some evidences in our culture right now that our culture is not doing a good job of instilling hope in people? There's a couple things that we could talk about. How about declining birth rates? People have said, sociologists have noted, that as people have less and less children, that's always a sign of less hope, because why would I want to bring a child into this world? That's one thing you could point to. What about increasing suicide rates? That's something that it just seems to keep going up. Increasing SSRI rates, medicines for like antidepressants, all those different sorts of things, those things keep going up as well. I think you could look at a lot of things that are going on in society and say, yeah, I don't know that I've been around a lot of people who could say that they have a lot of hope. I don't know that I've always seen it demonstrated in other people what hope actually looks like. And there's sometimes where I have this sensation where I think I have hope, but it's something that's kind of elusive to me. But yet we sing these hymns about hope, and our hope is like an anchor and all these things. How much have you experienced what it means to really have hope, to know that ultimately everything's going to be okay? You ever heard people say that? And if you feel, oh, everything's going to work out, everything's going to be okay. You know, for the Christian, that's actually true. That everything, because of Jesus and His resurrection, everything ultimately is going to be okay. But the secular approach that doesn't have the resurrection of Jesus, how would secular people try to cultivate some kind of hope? There's a woman named Catherine Osmond who wrote a book called Grace Without God. And in the book, she's talking about how she's gotten rid of Christianity in her life. She doesn't believe in the Bible anymore. She doesn't believe in the afterlife anymore. And so throughout the book, she's showing how she tries to still pursue an abundant life without God. And in the book, she explains some of the things that give her a sense of hope. That as I look forward into the horizon of my death, that these are the things that give me hope. And here's one of the things that she writes about. She's having this interview in the book with a professor in Claremont, California. And the professor's having this conversation with her about secular humanism. And here's a definition of humanism according to Catherine Osmond. We believe in making the world a better place. We believe in evidence over faith. We believe in reason as a way to address problems. We believe in helping others because that makes the world better for everybody. This is secular humanism. If you are into Marxism, who do you like to listen to and read from? Karl Marx. If you're into Buddhism, who do you like to read from and believe the writings of Buddha? If you are into humanism, what do you believe in? That human beings can come together and that we can solve the world's problems together. She believes in secular humanism, that if everybody binds together, we can make the world a better place. You talk to secular people, this is one of the things that they'll say, is they'll say, when I leave this world, I want it to be a better place. And by the way, do you think it's fair that Christians would say the same thing? I want to leave my grandchildren with faith. I want to leave my children with, you know, some money that we saved up so they can pay their house off, you know, whatever it might be, get a Cybertruck even. And so, like, I want to leave my sphere of influence better off. I get that. But the secular humanist says, my hope is that when I'm gone, there's been some kind of contribution that I've made to the world where it really has solved some problems. Doesn't that seem kind of naive? H.G. Wells wrote a lot of different books, War of the Worlds, The Time Machine, A Brief History of Time, things like this. And after World War I, and you guys all realize that they didn't call World War I World War I at the time because they weren't anticipating a sequel. So at the time, it was called the Great War. And so he says this after the Great War happened, H.G. Wells, can we doubt that presently our race will more than realize our boldest imaginations, that it will achieve unity and peace, that it will live, the children of our blood and lives will live, in a world made more splendid and lovely than any palace or garden that we know, going on from strength to strength, in an ever-widening circle of adventure and achievement? What man has done, the little triumphs of his present state, in all of this history that we have told, form but the prelude to the things that man has yet to do. So here was his perspective after the Great War. We've gotten all of our killing out of the way, and we had this war that impacted everybody, and now that we've kind of gotten that out of our system, I think it's just onward and upward from here. We've all seen how ugly all of this was, but 23 years later, the Second Great War happens. And can you imagine having this worldview? I think the future is all going to be good. That the war has happened, now everybody's going to make everything better. And then some years go by, and then Nazi Germany comes. And there's a bunch of stuff that happened, and now there's more cameras and ability to take videos and all of this that gets propagated throughout the world, and the whole world sees some of the atrocities of World War II. What do you think World War II does to this guy who thinks that everything's going to get better now? Well, he wrote his last book, he wrote a few months before his death, and it was called The Mind at the End of Its Tether, which is not, that tells you kind of how he feels, but he says this, the cold-blooded massacres of the defenseless, the return, he didn't think it was going to ever return, the return of deliberate and organized torture, mental torment, and fear to a world from which such things had seemed well-nigh banished has come near to breaking my spirit altogether. Homo sapiens, as he has been pleased to call himself, is played out. I thought we were going to make the world a better place, and some years go by, and then this other thing happens, and there's no way that it's actually ever going to get better. Have you ever seen a young person who thinks that we can go ahead and change society, and we can make everything better, and maybe for pockets of people you can make some contributions, but these problems are going to come back? It's naive to think that you're going to make this huge dent in the world. In fact, I don't know if you've ever heard of Norman Borlaug, but I'm related to him. And he won the Nobel Peace Prize for genetically modifying corn so that it could end world hunger. Has world hunger ended? Maybe made some contributions to those things, but it's not made a huge difference. It reminds me of what Ecclesiastes 1:15 says. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. Do you know what the world can do? I've done these Bible studies in Bowling Green on the college campus where there's like 45 or 50 students there. And I asked the class one time, all right, how many of you have taken a psychology class? And like everybody's hand goes up. You go, okay, what kinds of things did you learn about yourself in the psychology classes? Well, I kind of learned that I do this thing called projecting, where all the problems I see with everybody else is actually what I do. And I've kind of learned these other things. Okay, great, interesting. That's really fascinating. Now, raise your hand if these classes changed your life. Everybody's hand goes down. Do you know what the world can do? It can go, there's something crooked over here. There's something that's lacking over there. We can acknowledge that there's something wrong, but it can't fix the things that are wrong. Maybe we could illustrate it this way. Let's say that you're a secular humanist, and you have no hope after this life, and this planet's going to burn up one day from a solar flare, or we're going to nuke ourselves to death or something, I don't know. Imagine that you're on an airplane, and both engines go out because it's like giant like bird strikes. Maybe they were storks or something, I don't know. Like big enough birds to destroy both engines. And you're coasting, and you know you got 7 minutes before the plane crashes into a giant mountain. And you decide, well, I got 7 minutes left, so I'm going to stretch my legs, and I'm going to go to the bathroom. And you go to the bathroom, you know when you go into the door and you're like, how do you, is it in or out? And then the thing like that, you know what I'm talking about? And you eventually get the door locked, and when you lock it, the light's supposed to come on, but the light doesn't come on. You go, oh, this is really frustrating. So you do blah, 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 and open the door, and then you go find, you can't say stewardess because that's sexist. So you say, where's the steward human? Where's the steward human? So that I can let the steward human know that the light's not working on the airplane. So you get to the steward person's going to go, whoopee-doo. We're all about to die. Why do you care about making the bathroom a better place right now? If your worldview says there's eventually going to be no more consciousness, everything's going to collapse and be destroyed, why do you care about making this place better for anybody when it's not going to last in any way? Your worldview shouldn't make you care about that. But there's another issue with it. Not only is it naive to think that you're actually going to make a difference, but this idea of making a difference can't apply to everybody. We talked about this same idea on Friday night, that if your worldview can't apply to everybody, it's probably not a good worldview. I like what Timothy Keller says here. Imagine how ludicrous it would have been to sit down with a group of early 19th century slaves and say, there will never be a judgment day in which wrongdoing will be put right. There is no future world and life in which your desires will ever be satisfied. This life is all there is. When you die, you simply cease to exist. Our only real hope for a better world lies in improved social policy. Now, with these things in mind, go out there, keep your head high, and live a life of courage and love. Don't give in to despair. How would you feel walking up to a bunch of slaves saying something like that? Have you ever read the book Jesus and the Disinherited by Howard Thurman? He was a black minister in Georgia, and his mom was a slave. And the book begins with Howard Thurman being interviewed by a man from India. And this man from India, his perspective of Howard Thurman being a black man in the South, adopting the ideas of Christianity, this Indian man is saying, why have you adopted the religion of the people who have held you captive? Because it seems kind of weak that you guys would adopt the Bible when you learned about these things from your slave, the people that are owning, your masters. Have you ever thought about that question? Why there would have been black slaves in America that would have adopted the ideas of the scripture when they were hearing about some of these things by means of the masters? And so the rest of the book, Jesus and the Disinherited, is Howard Thurman answering that question. And what he says throughout the book is this, that Jesus and the things that he went through and the suffering he endured and the hope that he gave was something that sang to all of us. And he was so compelling, even though we were hearing about him through the lips of hypocrites, he was such a compelling person because there was hope and there was judgment day and there were things that we couldn't find in any other worldview. If you've never read that book, Jesus and the Disinherited, very good read. But this is the first approach that a secular person would say. Yeah, there's no final judgment day, all of that sort of thing, and so we just have to make the world a better place. You say that to people who can't even do anything to make the world a better place, and you've stripped them of any kind of hope. We were designed to need some kind of hope after this life, but there's a second approach that secular people have to hope. Another way that secular people try to develop hope is to just try to embrace death as a natural part of life that's beautiful. They try to reframe death as a beautiful part of the cycle that happens to everybody. This view is more like what you'll find in karmic religions, but this is becoming more common in our society right now. That Catherine Osment book, I'm going to show you another quote from this, but there's a part of the book as the book is wrapping up, and the chapter is answering, how does she have hope now without God? And she's in her daughter's bedroom, and the daughter's looking out across the street where there's a church building, and it's making the mom, the writer of the book, think about grandma and how grandma recently passed away. And the daughter turns around and she says, "Where do you think grandma is right now?" And for a moment, Catherine is thinking to herself what she would like to eventually tell her kid when the kid is older, but she doesn't have the heart to tell her what she actually thinks. But this is what she thinks to herself. Our bodies decompose, falling back into the earth, merging with all the other matter that makes up our planet. In the future, our decomposed bodies might provide nutrients to the trees. Someone might hang a swing from one of those trees or sit beneath the shade of its leafy branches or make a painted horse from its wood. Isn't that just really nice? 8-year-old, hey, where's grandma? Well, she's become a horse. And she goes on to say, I didn't want to scare her with the concept of our eventual oblivion. So she does. This is what she wants to be able to train her kid to believe, but she can't give herself the ability to say it in the moment. And so the idea of the secular person is, yeah, there's no more consciousness after we die, but your remains may go on to feed a tree. And that's kind of cool, isn't it? Well, even before that, Lion King, do you remember that conversation that Mufasa and young Simba have? Mufasa, everything you see exists together in a delicate balance. As king, you need to understand that balance and respect all the creatures, from the crawling ant to the leaping antelope. All right, so this is his dad training his son how to be the king of the jungle. Even though, have you ever thought about how lions don't live in the jungle? Like, if anything's the king of the jungle, it's definitely the tiger, because they actually live in jungles. I don't know why it's lions that are kings of the jungle, but whatever. So Mufasa is telling his son, you have to respect all animals. And then, you know, young Simba is like, well, you know, we're lions and we kill other things and we're pretty predatory. And so he's got a good question. But dad, don't we eat the antelope? But then Mufasa says, yes, Simba, but let me explain. I got a good answer to that one. When we die, our bodies become the grass, and the antelope eats the grass, and so we are all connected to the great circle of life, and we have the beautiful circle of life song and all that sort of thing. So your hope after you die is that you feed the grass. Now, let's think for a second about some of the problems with this view. Because have you heard of people in Washington State now, when you die, your remains get to help a tree grow? Like, there's more people doing all this kind of thing, and that's their hope. And so here's some problems with this. Number one, you don't have any control over your remains. If your hope is that my ashes might feed a tree, somebody might mess that one up. It might not actually work. Or, like Catherine Osment said, somebody might hang a tree from the leafy branches. Or somebody might cut that tree down and you know, make a carved horse out of it. Or how about this? Because if your hope is really what your remains are going to accomplish, what if somebody cuts down that tree and they make a baseball bat out of it? And then they put a bunch of barbed wire on that baseball bat. And they start breaking into houses and hurting people and stealing stuff. Oh no! You know, even with Mufasa, when he dies in Lion King, doesn't he die like in a canyon where his remains can't even feed the grass anyways? It's like his hope doesn't even get... That's kind of a savage comment. But so you have no control over your remains. But here's another one. if there is no consciousness after death, and you're like a dewdrop going back into the ocean, that means that there is no ultimate justice. As one person has said, no matter what you choose to believe or what good or evil actions you take in life, we all end exactly where we began, as stardust, like a drop of water falling back into the ocean. That, my friends, is the real horror. If you say that there's no God, there's no judgment day, there's no consciousness after death, then your same worldview says that there's no difference between Mao Zedong and Jesus Christ. There's no substantive difference. There's no difference between Genghis Khan and the Apostle Paul. And that's more horrifying than believing that there is a judgment day that actually sets things right. So there's no control over your remains. There's no ultimate justice. But also instinctively, we all know that death is an enemy. You ever talk to anybody who worked hospice? Have you ever seen anybody pass away? If you talk to people that have worked in hospice, that have seen a lot of people pass away, even if you're a strong Christian, what they'll say is the moment of death is still terrifying. What happens after death, I think strong Christians don't have fear. But the moment of death is still an enemy. 1 Corinthians 15 still refers to death as an enemy. 1 Corinthians 15, 25 and 26. For he must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. The last enemy to be destroyed is death. The 1 Corinthians is making the observation that death is an enemy. But this worldview says, well, we have to reframe it and look at it as a natural, beautiful part of how the world works. You remember during COVID, how there was like the death counters on the news? Like you're on CNN or Fox News and it was like, we're up to 500,000 deaths now and we're not foam finger number one. And, you know, United States has the most, it was this strange, the death counters. Nobody looked at the death counters and was like, wow, that's just beautiful. Look what nature's doing. You know, it doesn't work. So, what is the biblical approach to having hope? There's a lot of passages that you could look at that have a lot of beautiful things to say. But if I was going to pick the most concise way to answer this, I would go to 1 Thessalonians 4, 16 and 17. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the voice of the archangel, and with the sound of the trumpet of God. And the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we will always be with the Lord. Notice that this last part of this, we will always be with the Lord. The Bible story begins with God creating Adam and Eve in his presence. They're brought into the garden and God is there with them in the garden. And then they detach from him by thinking that they know better. And then God eventually comes and he gives the instructions on Mount Sinai. He wants them to build a tabernacle so that I may dwell among them. And the Israelites end up sinning again, and so God vacates the temple in Ezekiel 8 through 11. But then he eventually comes in the person of Jesus, that he's pursuing us. He wants to be with us. We were created to be with God. Have you ever felt homesick? So it's been 7 years since my family moved from San Diego, California. And there's still a big part of my heart that belongs in San Diego. That was probably the hardest decision I've ever had to make. And, you know, I've thought, if I were to ever move back there, maybe Josh would come. If I were to ever move back there, I'm sure it wouldn't be how I remember it. And so you go to this place, you know, we're going to build this custom home, and then but then there's still things about life, and it feels like there's always some kind of homesickness, and we can never really settle in, even if you're living in your favorite city. Because we were all built to be with God. We're all homesick until we're with Him. And one day we're going to be with the God of all comfort, the light of the world, the good shepherd, the refuge for the oppressed, the perfect father, the God of peace. He's the God of grace. He's our redeemer. You could sum up a lot of what God is, like 1 John does, with the word love. You know how the sun rises and feeds the earth with light? Like all the light that you can see out the windows, right? All that's emanating from the sun. All the love you've ever experienced in this life has emanated from God. Because the people who have loved you were people who learned that from God. It's all flowing upstream to Him, and we get to be with Him forever. Does that sound a little bit better than becoming a horse? Does that seem a little bit better than trying to make the world a better place when you may not have ever had the ability to make the world a better place at all? Well, notice though also in this passage in verse 17, then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. So we will always be with the Lord. This text is also referring to a reunion. I think most chiefly we're going to be with God, but I think part of what's going on in 1 Thessalonians here is that there's loved ones who have passed on, and we will be with them. The dead will rise first, and then we will all be together. In Buddhism and in pantheistic religions, it teaches that when you die, you lose all consciousness, and that's it. But this text, even after death, is referring to the dead in Christ, like they still exist, or we will be up with them. In the Christian worldview, in the biblical worldview, you will never stop being you. You're never going to stop being you. But when the Lord returns, we're going to be who we are perfected. You ever heard Christians say, if we can't get along on earth, how are we going to get along in heaven? You ever heard people bring that up? The truth is, how many of you guys, because I'm not part of this church, how many of you guys get along perfectly all the time with no issues? Does that find me any church on earth where that happens? The truth is, loving other people is agonizing and filled with pain. There's some reasons you could think about why loving other people and trying to work with other Christians at a church can be difficult. We want people to love us for our own sake. Have you ever met the Amway Christian? They're going to have you over for dinner, and I'm going to tell you about this business opportunity, and I'm going to try to use you to like get some sales through you. You know, like, we don't want people to use us as a stepping stone for something else. We want to be loved for our own sake. Do you think at any given local church, everybody just loves each other for their own sake perfectly all the time? No, that's agonizing. We want love to be mutual. I love that person, but they seem to have some issue with me, whatever. That's hard. We want our loved ones to be happy. I got four kids. If any one of them isn't doing too well, it's like a limp in my brain. Like, it's affecting everything I'm doing, and I can only be as happy as they're happy. We want to be able to love other people without having to say goodbye. I've been a Christian now for 17 years. And I haven't been a Christian long enough to know other Christians who have meant a lot to me to have them start passing away until 2 years ago. And there's a really godly woman, one of the elders' wives at the church in Bowling Green, who just was such a great woman, who passed away. First Christian that I was close to that passed away that I knew. And then, like, 8 months later, somebody from the church in California passes away. Very godly woman, filled with all kinds of sorrow. Her life was so difficult, but she had such a godly perspective about everything. You know how hard it is to say goodbye to somebody? And then you move from one place to another, and you got to say bye to people. We want to be able to love other people without ever having to say goodbye. And so when people say, if we can't get along on earth and love is agonizing on earth, how is it going to work in heaven? Well, here's the answer. We looked at this on Friday. 1 John 3:2, beloved, we are God's children now, and what we will be has not yet appeared, but we know that when He appears, we shall be like Him, because we shall see Him as He is. You will always be you, but you will be perfected. Along with everybody else that you had issues with, along with everybody else that you were envious of, along with everybody else that you maybe rubbed each other the wrong way, and there will be a time where you will all work together perfectly. All of this is because Jesus rose. No other worldview has a God so gracious that left the glories of heaven, the throne of heaven, and then came down to earth and had the thorns put on his head, who then leads the charge and breaks the bonds of death and then goes back up to the throne and then gives us the promise that you get to be with me and you also get to be with everybody else who's been made to be like me. Now you ask the question, what's better? Just trying to leave this world a better place and it's going to crash and burn anyways? And then you get to be a horse. Or you get to be with the God of all love and with other people who have been perfected in their love. We're about to sing the song that's meant to encourage us, I Am Coming, Lord. As we sang about before the lesson, all other ground is sinking sand. What are you standing on? All of us are going to die. And there's only one worldview that gives us the robust hope that we all know that we need instinctively. If there's anything that we can do for you, please come forward while we stand, while we sing.